What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif blames the intervention by outside powers for instability in West Asia. Sources close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council reject U.S. claims about indirect talks between Washington and Tehran on the 2015 nuclear deal. And the Yemeni military launches a new air raid on Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's aggression against the country. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says intervention by outside powers is one of the main causes of instability in West Asia.
I do not intend to offer a long list of deficiencies. We all know them. Yet we rarely look to the roots and causes. I believe there are three mega roots, namely international interventions, securitization, and prioritization. There can be no question that prolonged and dangerous international interventions in our region are one of the major reasons for existing troubles.
Zarif was speaking at the Tehran Dialogue Forum held virtually. He particularly criticized the U.S. for interfering in West Asia, blaming it for exacerbating the existing problems there, including insecurity. The top Iranian diplomat said the U.S. is meddling in the region to serve its own interests. Zarif also referred to U.S. sanctions against the Iranian nation and called the coercive measures an economic war. He stressed that diplomacy has to be taken more seriously to manage differences and resolve issues. The Turkish foreign minister was also present at the Tehran Dialogue Forum. Mevlut Çavuşoğlu called for stronger regional cooperation to tackle existing crises, including the Palestinian issue.
From Palestine to many other problems in our region, there is a need for stronger regional cooperation. However, not all news is bad news, and not all conflicts last forever. There is hope. Now, our broader regional cooperation is possible. This is what we hope and work for. If the existing opportunities are seized, reconstruction and rehabilitation will bring prosperity to the region. Iran will have an important role in this regard. And we are already in close contact with Brother Javad on these issues.
The top Turkish diplomat warned of threats terrorism poses to regional security and prosperity. He said a case in point is Syria, where the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh is also undermining the security of Iran and Turkey. He also rejected unilateral U.S. sanctions against Iran and said Ankara supports Washington's return to the 2015 nuclear deal. Also present at the virtual summit was Afghan Foreign Minister Hanif Atmar. He called for lasting peace in his country and said Afghanistan should not become a safe haven for terrorists. An Iranian security source has rejected remarks by White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan about indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. over the 2015 nuclear deal. A source close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council told Press TV that the country has not held any information, informal talks that is, with the U.S. about Washington's return to the multilateral agreement. The source stressed that no dialogue will take place before the U.S. lifts all sanctions on Iran. On Monday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry also said Tehran will not engage in any direct or indirect negotiations with Washington about any issue. Last week, Sullivan said the U.S. is in touch with its European and other allies to get to know Iran's position about the nuclear agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden wants Iran to return to full compliance with the deal before renegotiating it. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the United States has been seeking to exclude Iran from regional and international equations, but to no avail.
The United States has actively tried to exclude Iran from any regional or international arrangement, to demonize the great nation of Iran, and more importantly, make Iran as an exception in international politics, which have been obviously all failed.
Khatibzadeh made the comments at the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2021. He urged Washington to accept the realities in Iran as well as the region and the whole world. He said the U.S. is using all means available to counter countries which Washington is not happy with. The Iranian official said all U.S. administrations, including the current one, have used different strategies to avoid real multilateralism. Khatibzadeh said the White House has also been trying to prevent or delay a transition in international politics. He said the world, including the West, has been awakened to the wrong policies of the U.S. Moving on, Iran has launched the human and clinical trial of another domestically developed vaccine for the coronavirus. Present at the ceremony was Iran's health minister, Saeed Damaki. He said the vaccine has been produced using domestic scientific achievements and technologies. Damaki said the new COVID vaccine is called Fakhra and is the fourth one developed in Iran. He noted that the animal trial phase for the vaccine has successfully been concluded. The Iranian health minister said his country has been unable to procure medicines and medical equipment from abroad and tackle coronavirus due to U.S. sanctions. Namaki also said that the national vaccination drive will kick off very soon in Iran. The manager of Iran's project to produce Fakhra COVID vaccine earlier joined us and gave us more details about the jab.
We had to have animal trial and also quality control tests. We became certain about the safety of the vaccine. And then we studied its immunization rate in animals, and then the case was sent to the health ministry. Upon the confirmation by the ministry, we had the first injection today. We are going to start the first clinical phase, and then we have to move on to the second and third phases. If we get the right responses, I think that we can have the mass production phase next summer. We have started the process for mass production already. We have received all the authorizations. And I think that until early summer, we'll be able to utilize this process. We're going to start with 200,000 doses, but based on our planning, we can increase that figure to 1 million doses and even beyond that. It should be done in a step-by-step process.
Moving on, Yemeni armed forces have carried out yet another air raid against Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's aggression against the country. A spokesman for the Yemeni army said the Air Force has targeted an airbase in southwestern Saudi Arabia. According to the spokesman, two drones have been used to attack King Khalid Air Base near the Yemeni border. No further details are immediately available about the possible casualties or damages caused by the airstrike. Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has once again sounded the alarm over what it calls the sharp rise of civilian deaths due to the increase of bomb blasts and expansions of war fronts across the country. Amin Alemi reports.
Based on a report by Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, over 100 civilians, including women and children, were killed or wounded over the last 6 days alone. The rights body called international community to put pressure on both warring sides, mainly the Taliban, to reduce violence.
As our findings show, 13 civilians, including women and children, were killed and 93 others were wounded due to rising violence across the country only over the past 6 days. Therefore, we seriously call on the international community and other rights bodies to do whatever they can to put an end to misery of war-weary Afghans.
This comes as both the Afghan government and the Taliban accuse each other of targeting civilians, but facts on the ground show that terrorist groups such as Daesh and Taliban are responsible for much of civilian casualties.
There are multiple reasons in civilian casualties, such as terrorist attacks, the proxy wars, or unknown elements that are still in equations. But the war in Afghanistan is as complicated and bland as ever. People are still dying, life is still being torn apart, and the nation, global powers, most importantly the people of Afghanistan, are being drawn further into a situation that is hard to see a way of it.
However, the NATO troops are also accused of targeting civilian gatherings, such as wedding parties and religious events. This comes as, despite all political attempts to bring stability to Afghanistan, this is the Afghans who rarely bear the brunt of violence. Local Afghans say they welcome any agreement that leads the country to calm and security.
Afghan civilians lose their lives on a daily basis while the country's peace process is going to enter a new phase. The launch of separate summits in Russia and Turkey to discuss the fate of the peace process. Will those conferences bring peace to Afghanistan? Let's wait and see. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Now, as we told you before, the Yemeni armed forces have carried out another air raid against Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's aggression against their country. To get more details, we're joined by Abdul Latif al-Washali, our correspondent, who is joining us from Sana'a.
Actually, the Yemeni army has gutted successfully today the King Khalid air base in Khamis al-Mushayyit. The Yemeni army is targeting Saudi facilities almost on a daily basis. And the Yemeni army is now maybe the biggest threat to the Saudis, to the Saudi economy. The Saudi economy depends on oil, as it is an oil-rich country. So when the Yemeni army continues its attacks against Saudi facilities, whether they were military targets or oil targets, the Yemeni army is hitting and harming the Saudi economy, and these attacks will continue as long as the Saudis are continuing their war and saving the Yemeni people.
Thank you very much, our correspondent Abdul Latif al-Washali from Sana'a with the details of the recent attack on Saudis from Yemeni forces. Moving on, UN Secretary General has urged the international community to help bring an end to the repression of anti-coup protesters in Myanmar. A UN spokesman said Antonio Guterres is appalled by the escalating violence there, that after the crisis his Southeast Asian nation saw another bloody day on Sunday when nearly 40 people lost their lives protesting against the last month coup. According to the UN, at least 138 protesters have been killed across the country since February the 1st. Some local sources put the death toll at over 180. More than 2,000 people have also been arrested. The military took over an elected government and detained officials, including the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, over allegations of voter fraud in the last election. Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, says the UN Security Council must seriously intervene to stop the bloodshed in Myanmar.
And you have, hundreds of thousands of people in Myanmar taking to the streets. There's this huge protest, and plus a general strike. So the international community is making some noise, but the problem is that the Myanmar military is. Even though there's been an embargo of arms, has been getting access to Israeli technology, American technology, and European technology, which they're using to crack down on the protesters. So that is a big problem. And of course, the United Nations Security Council should take a strong stand. They've imposed sanctions against some of the Myanmar generals, but they need to have a much more forceful stand and maybe even require some sort of intervention. You know, UN can respond to, you know, problems in Venezuela and Iran and Syria and us in a much more forceful way. But here we have a much worse situation in Myanmar, and the international community seems to be unable to come forward with any sort of serious effort to bring about an end to the killing and to the protests and restore democracy in Myanmar.
This week, the British Parliament is debating the government's police crime and sentencing and courts bill aimed at giving police wider powers in the wake of the vigil of Sarah Everett, the 33-year-old woman whose death prompted a safety debate in the UK. But as Saeed Pourreza reports, the bill is facing backlash from across the political spectrum as a clampdown on protests continues.
The debate over the policing of a London vigil on March 13th for Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman allegedly kidnapped and murdered by a serving British police officer earlier this month, is ongoing. What had been a peaceful and respectful demonstration of female solidarity turned ugly. Police moved in, pushing and shoving the demonstrators, and took away some of the women in handcuffs.
I've never been in a situation like this before, so I just thought, well, if I just don't say anything, I'm not sure what to do. But, you know, I just stood there, and I know a police officer was pulling my arm, trying to get my name, and then all of a sudden, I was tackled to the ground.
The sight of women who had come to stand together against male violence being manhandled led to a chorus of criticism from across the political spectrum. Attention soon shifted to this woman, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick, forced to explain her officer's actions to the authorities and to defend herself.
I don't think anybody who was not in the operation can actually pass a detailed comment on the rightness and wrongness of it.
She has so far rejected calls for her resignation from those she described as armchair critics who believe police handling of the vigil was heavy-handed. But she has the backing of the government. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he has full confidence in her. In fact, the force she leads may be getting the powers she asked for after the Extinction Rebellion protests of 2019, a new law and order bill. Critics, among them conservative MPs, have called it a mess and an attack on people's right to protest.
300 or so pages, 170-something clauses, and almost nothing, if you can believe it, on violence against women and girls. The gaping hole in this bill is why we'll be voting against it.
The main focus of the criticism of the bill is its wording. For example, it gives the police the power to impose conditions on processions and public assemblies if the noise generated by the persons taking part may result in serious disruption to the activities of an organization which are carried out in the vicinity.
I'm really worried about it. It gives the police a lot of powers to decide what they think is an unacceptable protest, powers that can be decided later in law. It's not very clear. Just their conception of what might be a public annoyance or nuisance is potentially going to be a reason to shut down a protest and for prison sentences of up to 10 years. That's a bit of an assault on democracy.
Just imagine going to jail for making noise or causing inconvenience. The British government will have some tough questions to answer from MPs on its new policing bill, such as how it defines such unspecified terms as noise or serious inconvenience, and how giving sweeping, ill-defined powers to the police will affect freedom of expression in this country. Saeed Pourreza, London.
And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Saving Capitalism, directed by Jacob Cornbluth. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, Saving Capitalism is a documentary that explores the reasons why the economic system that once made the US strong is suddenly failing. The film is a clear-eyed examination of a political and economic status quo that no longer serves the people, exposing the powerful alliances between Washington and Wall Street, as well as the extreme wealth disparity in the US. And starring Robert Reich, and whose book inspired the film, served as Labour Secretary under President Bill Clinton, takes us through the US's fragile democracy and its fight for survival, and argues that it's up to ordinary US citizens to change the rules.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules. We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind. And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary under President Clinton.
I want to go to places where I could actually interact. I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true. As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power. Money! People don't trust that our society is working for most people. Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it. The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active. New York now! New York now! Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So I found this film an enlightening watch, and I think it offers an effective crash course on US inequality, particularly on the economy. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
It's a really easy film to watch. It's made in a kind of gentle, smoothly edited, it carries you along, it's intriguing, it's gripping. And Robert Reich is a really great central character. He's kind of warm and a little bit scruffy and impish and funny.
Very entertaining to watch.
He's very entertaining, and the things he says are incredibly pointed and they grab your attention. The central topic of the film is really strong. I don't know, I mean, the title is a little bit, I think, misleading almost, because I think it will put off a lot of viewers. But the central idea of the fact that, you know, the economic system in America is tilted so heavily toward corporations, is a really important message that I think needs to get out there. And so you're watching it, you feel your blood starting to boil. It's one of those documentaries that starts making you more and more angry, even as it kind of gives you some ideas of the way forward or what's likely to happen.
And so, Clive, if I could turn to you, as a political economist, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
My first reaction was that it was something of a political pitch. And it was very articulate, very well done. It articulated the symptoms extremely well. Whether Reich's prescription for the remedy is appropriate, I would question, because it's the pendulum swinging back and forth. And Reich emerged in the 60s and 70s, and he seems to hark back to that as some sort of golden era. but that was just a temporary blip post-war in this long war of attrition, which is effectively what they managed in the 60s and 70s, both in the UK and in the US, was some sort of social contract, which was a renegotiation of the terms of slavery. But slavery certainly wasn't abolished, and I'm not sure that the thrust of this film gets us any closer to abolishing slavery, which is effectively what this system is.
Well, I suppose this documentary could only cover so much ground in 90 minutes or so, but I'm just wondering, as someone who's not familiar with the economy, does this serve as a good introduction to get to grips with what capitalism is and the arguments that Reich makes?
Yeah, and I thought it was quite interesting. I was making notes as the film unfolded, and I was writing down names that I thought ought to have been mentioned, and sure enough, they come in. He mentions Robert Rubin as Treasury Secretary. And you look at the sort of Clinton administration dynamic, and to some extent, Reich was in there as the pigeon. And he fought very hard, and he said, you know, my only regret was I didn't push harder. The irony is he probably doesn't recognize that he couldn't have pushed harder, or he would have been out, or he wouldn't have got anywhere anyway. So I think it's, for all his 5 decades of experience, I'm not sure he's learnt the game sufficiently. He didn't realise the pool, the shark-infested pool in which he was operating.
Now, we see his character sort of, and his character progression throughout the documentary, actually, and how sort of down-spirited he becomes, but also hopeful as well. But, Rich, just wanted to ask you, for viewers not well-versed with the economy, do you think this film serves as a good introduction, then?
Well, it's very interesting. It's obviously from a particular point of view, but what it does explain in the way that I haven't heard explained quite so simply and straightforwardly is how the whole economy was founded on a principle that was flawed, mm-hmm. basically tilted toward the wealthy and corporations right from day one, mm-hmm. and how people with power just consolidate their power. So it's only gotten worse over the last 250 years, and it's just, you know, now the general average person in America has no power really politically. Which is quite a shocking thing to say, but when you think about it, it's true. And you look at the way laws are being passed and the way the government is behaving, mm-hmm. that's kind of how it's working. And but you see little, you know, people taking bites out of it. So I think the system has room to correct itself, and that helps. While you're watching the film, it helps you not be completely hopeless.
A strong argument to be made in this film, and of course aided by great animation sequences, yeah. and graphics as well.
Yeah.
Tuition right now is clear. Something's wrong. All over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's way off.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, that's
but
great.
What we're beginning to see, yep. is that it's actually anti-establishment,
yeah.
versus establishment.
Yep.
It's people who don't want the big money and the crony capitalism versus the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, there's going to be disagreement on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could come together on these,
yeah.
fundamentals.
It's fine with me. You're at a deeper level, right? You've been teaching economics and all that for 30 years. I used to use your book.
You, yeah. used to use my book?
I used to use it.
Can
book
we just make,
nation.
Can you?
And
can
I have a book out, too.
Can we get that again? Congressman, what do you think of the title?
Yeah, I know. It surprised me a little bit coming for you, but in a pleasant way. I think you and I are united on if we can do this in the right way, ethics and capitalism together, and we'll save the country.
I think what's interesting about this documentary is that Reich manages to put Republicans, both them and Democrats, around tables and get them to agree with him, actually, on this issue. And do you think Reich has sort of that political authority to do that?
Well, I mean, he is Democrat, and he's very kind of entrenched in that world. But I like the fact that he's looking beyond that. He's looking at the point that this is about an establishment, anti-establishment thing. He talks about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being anti-establishment. They're opposite ends of the political spectrum. But basically what they were proclaiming or what they were trying to do was the same thing, just overthrow the system. And,
but
and that's quite interesting. It's quite interesting that he's brought them both into the story.
Indeed, and I think at the time, we see Trump there. It was the early elections when they were, yeah. filming this documentary, and it was the front runners were Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. But I don't think they could have foreseen that Trump would have won.
well, no, nobody foresaw that, did they?
No, not at all. But I think the argument made in the film, though, is perhaps this anti-establishment sort of notion is that Trump was bringing corporate power to influence political power, which, of course, this documentary highlights. Would you agree with that, Clive?
Undoubtedly, and we've seen what's happened since. Trump has populated his administration with Goldman Sachs alumni and the usual suspects. So the system is so, corporate influence is so embedded in the system. And Reich talks about lobbying, but lobbying is just the sort of the visible tip of the iceberg. It's basically embedded in the whole superstructure.
Well, the tax law that they passed was just purely aimed at helping corporations.
Exactly. So you know, what we call the civil servants in this country, the administrative engine is fully embedded with corporate interests, and the idea that changing the figurehead from red to blue, or Democrat to Republican, or vice versa, is going to change anything. We saw it with Obama. We've seen it with Trump. You know, and you know, should this be a platform for another Bernie Sanders? It'll be exactly the same story. One has to question the system rather than the political flavor. And I think, frankly, I found that conversation with the Republican senator somewhat naive, really.
Oh, so Rich, what do you think about actually the arguments made in this documentary about the relationship between political power and the economy and corporate interests? Does it make strong arguments bringing the two together?
Well, it does. I mean, it makes very strong arguments that the people who have the money have the power. It's kind of obvious. But it's quite creepy to watch a film like this where they explain how that plays out through the lobbying, through the passage of laws, through financial contributions to campaigns, and then getting, you know, favors on the back end of that. And you realize that the system is just kind of eating itself, and it's very much it's perpetuating that corporate power and that kind of inequality to where the middle class is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
So perhaps not surprising, but very telling.
It's not surprising, but it kind of helps. It helps you understand what's happening, because everybody knows this is happening, but nobody really gets why or how how it's affecting them. And this kind of helps. It helps you understand it a little bit better, and perhaps gives you a voice. I mean, that's what this kind of a film does. It might get people to stand up and say, "Wait a minute." Something has
it's
to happen.
It's an empowering documentary.
Yeah.
And there's
a moment in the film where they mention that this happened 100 years ago, which is really interesting. The exact same thing. And there was a huge backlash. The public came out protest. They elected all new people. They passed all these laws, which have pretty much all been overturned now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It's interesting that, you know, we're kind of repeating history. Mm-hmm. So
I would like to touch on that actually a bit more in the next section.
I've been working at McDonald's for 4 years. I work at the drive-thru window. I get paid $12.55 per hour. I make about $1,200 a month. $900 goes straight to rent, and I have to pay for gas. And then my phone bill, I end up with nothing. I sometimes have to go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Nobody should be working full-time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious and as insecure as so many people do today.
That was a truly heartbreaking scene to watch there. And Rich, what did you make of these sort of contributions to the documentary, these stories, the McDonald's worker, and also we saw a farmer in the documentary also?
I think it's just an example of the thing that a lot of people are feeling, and it's regardless of what your political views are, that feeling like, why is life getting worse? Why is my paycheck not going as far as it went 5 years ago? Why do I feel like I'm earning less money and everything costs a lot more? There's something wrong here. When the wealthy people are just getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and they're buying cars and houses and they're living and they're talking about how booming the economy is, and I'm not feeling that. And those stories reflect that, reflect something that almost all of us feel, unless we're in that top 1%, I think.
And Clive, I want to ask that question that Robert Reich raises. Why is it that people who are working full-time are struggling to make ends meet in one of the richest countries in the world?
There's an inevitability in where we've got to. I referred earlier that the post-war consensus did actually give people some semblance of a decent life. They were working hard, but they were being well rewarded. They didn't have to have multiple jobs. But I think that respite was only temporary, and there's a much deeper underlying problem than what the documentary brings out. But what the documentary, the power of the documentary, is that it begins people on a journey of understanding. It may not go the whole way, but it certainly introduces concepts that may be totally alien to them, and having these stories actually puts them into the context of their own lives. But there is an inevitability to this idea that things get worse and worse, because essentially the wealth is sucked to the top, and there are very simple mechanisms that drive that, and it's to do with theft of what should belong to everyone, land, resources, etc., and usury, because it's just a straight interest on money, it's just a straight wealth transfer mechanism.
She said she had to take payday loans.
Exactly.
And of course,
so that just exacerbates it. So this process, inevitably, in days gone by, we had debt jubilees. And basically everything would be forgiven, we'd start afresh, and the system would reset. 1929 was a reset, and that's why all those laws were so effective, because it reset the economy. We had a crash in 87, we had a crash in 98, we had a crash in 2000, we had one in 2008. We've not had a reset. All that's happened is that the Fed has continued to pile more money into the system, which has done nothing to alleviate the hardship of people like that lady at McDonald's, but it's gone into asset price. It's driving more of the wealth to the top. So the system needs a reset, and the fear is that the reset will be much too painful. It'll be like the 1930s depression. And if we want to avoid that, we have to think in a different way. That doesn't come out of the film, but if this starts people on a journey of
understanding, at least it's a good starting point.
I think it does a very good job of opening the door to concepts that people probably don't think about, although they feel them, as Rich says, on a daily basis in their own lives.
And Rich, before we move on, I just quickly wanted to touch on the point you made about Reich earlier on, about him. You can tell, you get a sense from the documentary, he's trying really hard. He's been a senior political figure in America, but it doesn't seem like he's getting anywhere, and you can see his spirits sort of go down throughout the years.
It's just you know, watching the system get worse and worse, and he talks about seeing the seeds of what we're seeing now, seeing it back in the 80s, you know, and realizing that this was going to happen. It was just going to get worse and worse. And
you can feel the sense of frustration from him.
Yeah,
also.
You do see him getting frustrated. And you saw him, like, in the clips from when he was working with Clinton, and he's trying to change things. And, of course, he can't, because every bill he proposes is heavily compromised by exceptions and things, and which just basically made the situation even worse. Mm-hmm. So you do watch him kind of getting more and more demoralized. And then this film is basically his journey around the country to try to make sense of that and work a way forward. It is, like you say, it's an opening of the door to the theme. It doesn't really get that deep into it, but it helps you understand in a way that you kind of makes you think, and you think, oh, maybe I do need to pay attention to the candidates more when the next election comes around, and pay attention to what they're saying.
Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars. With the four drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month per treatment. But for me, that's about 3 months of income. just for one round of treatment.
What is the alternative to receiving your chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than
any citizens of any advanced nation.
So you would think medicine should save people, not bankrupt them. Rich, what impression did you get of the pharmaceutical industry from this documentary?
Personally, you know, I live in the UK, and our government right now is trying to create that system here, which is terrifying to me. That's terrifying.
Increasing privatization.
Yeah, and making it so that we have to pay for everything, even though we already pay for it. Mm-hmm. I find that really disturbing. But, this clip is part of a bigger point in the film, because he talks about how Americans pay more for airfares, they pay more for, you know, virtually everything. Internet access, mobile phones, everything is more expensive because of these special interests that have created laws that basically give them bigger profits. And that these companies are regulated outside of America because they're considered public utilities and they're not allowed to have obscene profits. Mm-hmm. Because they're utilities. They're something everybody has to have. Mm-hmm. And
it's essential.
And that's kind of it's a bigger point in the film, is that these essential services shouldn't be allowed to make, you know, obscene profits.
And
make people poor, basically.
Would you agree with what Rich said? Your thoughts on the sort of free-for-all economy?
On the pharmaceutical industry specifically, I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how we got here. One of the original Rockefellers was a snake oil salesman, and he basically, through endowing universities, medical schools, and health facilities, basically alienated the whole idea of natural medicine. That lady said there's no alternative. There are alternatives, actually effective alternatives. And the pharmaceutical industry is not about curing people, it's about making money. And if people get better, that's a side benefit. It's certainly not the main thrust. So the cost is part of this, but it's actually the industry itself is perpetuating illness because it's profitable. And if you look at the insured model, and Rich mentioned what's happening in this country, you go back pre the start of this privatization regime, management costs in the UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a secret study done. It's not been published. It's been available through leaks in various places. I think we're up to about 14%. Yeah. But where we're heading to is 20% of the cost going into management. In other words, going back up to
that is
the
very
top.
Worrying indeed. And just as we end in near the end of the show, I'd just like to discuss one of the key messages of this documentary, which is the power of ordinary citizens, I suppose, to rise up and to challenge the 1%. Clive, do you think? I'm sorry, Rich. Do you think that this documentary ends on a hopeful note?
I mean, so many of these documentaries that make you angry end up by saying, you know, vote, use your vote, get out and protest, and you know, that message has been going on for, we're 10 years into this economic system, this new world that we're living in, and it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. So,
just your final thoughts on the film now.
Yeah, so I think the film helps raise issues that need to be raised, and we need to watch these kinds of films so that we understand what's going on, and maybe that will help us use our vote more wisely and get out and protest where it's effective. But it does kind of make you feel a little hopeless.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to end it on a sad note there. But I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters all around the globe, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program for Humanity on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about one of the rights which is mentioned in the book, The Treatise of Rights of Imam Ali Zainul Abidin, the son of Hussein ibn Ali alayhim wassalam. May Allah's peace be upon all of them. In it he says, alayhi salam, and the right of him who seeks your advice is that you should exert all efforts to advise him if you can provide him with a good opinion. He further says, and suggest to him to choose what you would have chosen if you were in his shoes. You should do so with mercy and with lenience, since lenience will eliminate fear, while rudeness will eliminate friendliness. But if you do not have any good advice for him, you should refer him to someone else whom you know and trust his advice for yourself. You should spare no efforts to guide him towards the good and do your best to advise him. And there is no power but in Allah. Thus says Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam in The Right of Him Who Seeks Your Advice in the book The Treatise of Rights. In the previous program, we were talking about different examples from the history of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, where he is the embodiment of the noble Quran. He's the walking Quran. He's the Quran which talks, which walks on the earth. And if there is a command from Allah in the Noble Quran, be sure that the Prophet is the first person who will go according to that command and will practice that command with the best manner possible. We were talking about one of the examples in history that we can take lessons from, which was the peace treaty of Hudaybiyah. In the peace treaty of Hudaybiyah, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam adopted the general view of his close followers and convened a peace treaty between Muslims and Quraysh, who were idolaters, and time proved that such a treaty was in the best interest of the Muslims, even though some companions strongly disagreed with him. However, consultation and seeking advice in Islam differs completely from that carried out in other democratic states. Now, before I go into that, let us go back and refer to what Imam Ali Zainul Abidin said. When you seek advice, or the one who seeks your advice, you should do so with mercy and with lenience. And you see that some companions strongly disagreed with the Prophet, and they did not have any fear of expressing that strong disagreement with the opinion of the Prophet. And later on, they understood that Haqq was with the Prophet, the right was with the Prophet, he had the best of opinions. But you see the environment that dominated among the companions. They were not afraid of telling their opinion. So the Prophet surely showed how to be mercy and show mercy and lenience towards those who seek your advice and eliminate any fear or rudeness. However, as I said, consultation in Islam differs from consultation in democratic states. And I will talk more about it, inshallah, after the break. So please join us afterwards.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters, to the program For Humanity. We were talking about one of the rights which is mentioned in the book, The Treatise of Rights of Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. And I was talking about consultation in Islam, which differs from the consultation carried out in some democratic states, in which the ratification of laws must be carried out by the Senate or the House of Representatives. The President is the administrator who should put the laws passed by these two legislative bodies into force. Here in Islam, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam has to follow neither the majority nor the minority. It is up to the Prophet to arrive at the final decision of whether or not his decision is in harmony with the majority. Then according to the Noble Quran, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam has to rely on Allah. Besides, referring to the general consensus is only applicable in those cases where the tasks of the Muslims have not been explained to them. Under such conditions, Muslims can become aware of their tasks. In those cases where their tasks have been put down, there is no need for consultation. For this very reason, when Al-Habbab ibn al-Munzir came to meet the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam to get permission to change the location of the army headquarters, he told the Prophet, "If concerning this there is a special divine command from Allah, we have nothing to say. But if it is among the issues where consultation is required, we think it is better to change the location of the military headquarters." So basically what the companion is asking the Prophet, by you putting the army headquarters in that spot, in that area, was it a revelation from Allah or was it your opinion, O dear Prophet? The Prophet said, "No, it was my opinion. You're allowed to give advice." And this dear companion gives advice that we should change the location in the Battle of Badr. And because of that, they were able to win the battle. Another example that we could give is the example of Zayd, the adopted son of the Prophet, which married Zainab, which later on became the wife of the Prophet. Now, the Prophet married Zainab after the divorce of Zayd and Zainab. Now, the majority opinion at that time was that this was a wrongful act from the side of the Prophet. But the Prophet went on, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave the permission and said that your adoptive sons are not your sons, not your biological sons. And he broke a taboo in that society. And here again, we see that the Prophet did not go according to the opinion, the majority opinion. So we see that the Prophet can follow the minority opinion or the majority opinion, according to what is right, according to Allah and the Noble Quran. And it beholds not a believing man nor a believing woman that they should have any choice or opinion when Allah and His Prophet have decided a matter. And whoever disobeys Allah and His Prophet, he surely strays off a manifest stray. With that, I would like to end, and please follow us in future programs where we will talk more about this specific right, the right of him who seeks your advice from Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. You can follow us on parstoday.com, and also please give us your suggestions and your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.